Good evening. I'm Bruce Robinson, and this is a special presentation of KRCB News, a live conversation with Congressman Lynn Woolsey about health care reform. It's an important issue, a complex issue, and one that many people feel strongly about, including our Democratic representative from the 6th Congressional District. Lynn Woolsey, thank you for taking time to talk with us tonight.
Thanks for having me, Bruce.
Now, a little later in the program, we're going to take some listener calls. So if you'd like to pose a question to the Congresswoman here on the air, the number to call is 584-2020. That's in the 707 area code, 584-2020. But before we get to your calls, I'd like to cover a few basics to set the stage. First of all, Lynn, you're a strong supporter of the single-payer approach, as you've written in various articles locally and have said at some length, but that never seemed to really get any serious consideration as health care reform was being debated on Capitol Hill. Why was that?
Well, it wasn't going to move through the Senate at all, and the moderate to conservative Democrats weren't going to support it, so the progressives, and we're 84 strong in the House and the Senate, we decided that what we would do is put all of our effort behind a robust public plan so that we could lead the way once this public plan proves itself to the possibility of a Medicare for all or a single-payer system.
And right now, the big fight seems to be over even that public option. Can you characterize what that is and how it differs from a single-payer?
Well, the single-payer would stand alone without any private insurance competition. And what the public plan does is offers a choice to individuals who are looking for their health coverage, and they could pick the single, they could pick the private option instead of one of the public insurance plans.
How do you feel about that as a starting point?
Well, I think health care reform without a robust public option is not going to be something we can call health care reform.
What makes it robust? What's the breaking point where it ceases to be strong enough to be worthwhile to do?
Well, a public plan that's based on the Medicare provider network and with an infrastructure and rates set by the administration, and those rates can be also based on Medicare. It could be Medicare Plus, but it wouldn't be rates that you're negotiating with the private insurance carriers.
Have you seen the general sense of support for this concept on Capitol Hill wax or wane? Would you say it's getting stronger, or has all the sniping that's been taking place begun to chip away at it?
Well, actually, it's been strong with the public from the very beginning. So if anything, it's getting stronger. But with, you mean with the elected officials, with members of the House and the Senate?
Exactly.
Well, it's getting stronger with the members of the House. Our leadership, our speaker, has come out stating that as far as she's concerned, health care reform needs to include a public option. And the president's Secretary of Health and Human Services said some words about it not being that important, and the president came back the next week saying, oh, well, he supports a public option. So they are, and the speaker has said she cannot pass out of the House any health care reform that does not include a public option. She would not have the votes.
Now, there was a big mention made in the Press Democrat a few weeks back when you and Mike Thompson sort of came to a common ground. Was that a difficult conversation to get to that point for the two of you?
Well, no, because I've been where I've been from the beginning. I mean, I would have preferred, and so would have the entire Progressive Caucus. You know, I'm the chair of the Progressive Caucus.
Yes,
I co-chair it with Raul Grijalva from Arizona. Our Progressive Caucus would have voted practically 100%, all 85 of us, or 84, however many we have at any one time, for a single payer. So we knew that by compromising for a robust public plan was our line in the sand.
And I just recently, Russ Feingold came out with a similar stance over on the Senate side, where he's been kind of a lonely voice, and now Ted Kennedy isn't there. Is that going to, how do you see that playing out in terms of the climate in which this is all going to get debated as you go back?
Well, to honor Senator Kennedy and not to squander his efforts over the last 30 years, we should be debating only the strongest of health care reform, and we should not be bringing forward anything that's just tweaking around the edges of fixing private health insurance. I mean, if we were going to do that, we could have done that easy pie years ago. But if we're talking about real health care reform, then we need to honor Senator Kennedy's passing and make sure we do that in for him. And let's call it the Ted Kennedy Health Care Reform Bill.
Just as a reminder for folks who've just come along, we're talking live with Representative Lynn Woolsey about health care reform. And if you'd like to pose a question to the Congresswoman here on the air, the number to call is 584-2020. And we'll get to some of those calls in a moment. In fact, we have one who just left a question for you, and I'll quote from him. Kirk asks, when will the Democrats, including President Obama, get some backbone and stand up to the people who refuse to be mollified on this issue? That's been a real difficult situation.
Well, I can tell you the Progressive Caucus has a lot of backbone. We signed a letter, 60 members of the House that I passed, wrote and passed around. 60 members signed a letter to the president and to our leadership before we left and out for the August break, saying that we would not vote for anything that did not include a robust public option. And that was following the last 3 months. We have met with the speaker, we've met with the president, we have said the same thing, and we mean it totally.
Do you see any idea or movement from the White House to suggest that they're hearing that and acting on it?
Well, the president unsaid what his Secretary of Health and Human Services said when two Sundays ago, when she said that she could give up the public option to get as a compromise, so she could get a health care reform passed. Well, that may have been a balloon, you know, Bruce, that they float up in the air. Well, that balloon lost its air,
didn't it?
That balloon lost its air almost immediately. And so the president has come out again once more and said he supports a public option. Now, the thing is, we have to know what they mean. You know, we know what we mean by a public option, and we've defined it every time. But we're going to redefine it for them so that they know what we mean. And when it passes out of the House, if it's good and strong, then we mean the same thing when it comes back in conference from the Senate.
Let's talk about costs for a moment. The Government Accounting Office, the GAO, questioned some of the administration's numbers on the fiscal impacts of the plan early on, and that seemed to provide a lot of ammunition for the conservative critics, who all of a sudden now are anti-deficits. And so they've been using that as an argument against universal coverage or even expanded coverage. So how much of an affordability issue do you see there being in the current economic climate for this bill?
Well, when one in every $6 that we spend in our economy is spent on health care, fixing it has to save money, and it will, and in the long run. And everybody, they know that. People know that. And if that means we can't afford to cover 48 uninsured individuals because we think we're saving money, that is just a false economy. We have people sicker and going into the emergency room and all the things we know that don't work and that cost more in the long run. But actually, this plan, as it's outlined, will cut costs in the long run. And a public option costs way less. And that's one of the reasons we want to have that public option, because it provides the competition to the private health carriers so that they will have to take another look at what they charge. You see, a public plan will not have the overhead that a private plan has. The public option doesn't have to pay their executives in the six figures or more every year, and they don't have to pay stockholders. So the 30% that the private plans have to invest in overhead, the public plan can invest in health care.
So this concern that's been expressed about the private insurance industry being facing unfair competition, what do you make of that?
I think that is the silliest argument I ever did hear. Of course they have to be able to put up with some competition because they have run the show for all these years, and they either can't or won't make it possible for every American to have affordable, quality health care. It hasn't happened, and they need the competition. We need to make sure that they get on board and start providing what the public plan could provide.
I would say that probably the death panel issue was even sillier than that one.
What are you talking about?
Well, the concern about the federal death panels, it would be...
Oh, the death panels. Oh, I know. That's so ridiculous. But I'll tell you what is in the plan is the ability for families to counsel with their doctors and plan whether their loved one goes... And the loved one can be part of it, whether hospice is the next step or what they want to do. And... physicians and healthcare providers work with families in that regard, but they don't get paid for it. So this says is, like with Medicare, the private insurers will also, under their plans, pay for end-of-life counseling. But it isn't how to die. It isn't. Well, you know that. I'm not going to go there.
Just in the past hour, there was a demonstration up in Santa Rosa in support of health care reform. It was organized by some local doctors and nurses in Old Courthouse Square, downtown Santa Rosa. Move On has had some public events, including a vigil in support of the public option or single-payer approach. Yeah. So here in your home district, where there are a lot of active, progressively inclined residents, my impression is that a lot of this fervor is in part a reaction to all of this noisy and well-funded effort to water down meaningful reforms or, you know, undo them altogether. I'm wondering what kind of messages you've been getting from your constituents and anybody else, and how that mail or feedback has changed over the last 4, 5, 6 months.
Well, first of all, you know that I'm going to have a town hall on Friday.
Yes, we should.
Monday at the Veterans Hall in Petaluma at 6 o'clock. And how has the message changed? The great, great majority of the people in this district that come from this district that call us are supportive of where I am. Actually, they say they'd rather have a single payer. But and those that aren't are respectfully, you know, at odds with my desires for a robust public plan.
It has stayed respectful for the most part.
Yeah, for the most part. But then those who are obvious. Well, we know from telephone codes and all that. We know who's calling us from out of town, and they aren't polite at all. And we know who's sending us emails out of our district because we can't respond to those, but they are identified on our computers, and they haven't been respectful either. So we know the difference, and so when we have our town hall, I'm assuming that and not everybody's going to agree, and many people are going to want to learn something, and others are going to want to support, and we're just going to have a good conversation.
Now, you already did a online or a telephone conversation town hall meeting recently. How did that go?
We had 7,000. This was my third telephone town hall, and we had planned this way before all of this brouhaha was happening with the healthcare town halls. This was something we had planned to do during the August break, and we just turned it into a one-subject telephone town hall, and the subject being healthcare. It went very, very well. And I think there were a lot of cross-sections of questions that were asked and answered.
7,000 people is more than you could fit into just about any hall in the district.
Right, that's for sure. The Veterans Building in Petaluma holds 700.
And just a reminder that is going to be on Monday evening at 6 o'clock, that anybody who's interested can be there. And you're going to be there for the duration, I understand, Lynn. You're going to stick
absolutely.
It out for quite a while.
I had not expected to have any security because I don't think there's going to be any problems. But the Veterans Building has insisted, and so in order to have to get it, they called us today, and we've rented it on Monday, so last Monday. So they've said they want to have security, so the Petaluma police will provide that security.
When you get back to Washington, which is, what, just after Labor Day?
Yes, when the Tuesday after Labor Day.
Is this like the top of the agenda, I assume?
Oh, I'm absolutely sure it is. This, first of all, the House has to merge the three bills that have passed out of the committees with jurisdiction over health care. I'm on one of those committees, education and labor. We marked up, that's called, we debated and added to and took away from the health care bill that came out of education and labor from 10 in the morning until 6 in the morning. We had a 20-hour stint.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, it was a long day and night and morning. But so, and then Ways and Means has a bill, and it's very much like our Ed and Labor bill. And then Energy and Commerce has a bill, and it truly weakens the public option. So all three of those bills are going to have to be merged somehow or another, and then we'll have to, then we will be voting on the House floor for the House bill.
What's the process for that? Is there the equivalent of a conference committee that tries to make the sausage?
Well, probably not as we're speaking. It's pretty late in D.C. today, tonight. But staff of the three committees are working together over this August break, and things that are obvious that all three bills have that are the same, and that are, you know, will just be, you know, put in place, and then the parts where we differ. And one of the places where we will differ, just for an example, I guess nobody's calling, so I can chat, right?
Yes.
Okay, one of the places where we differ is in the education and labor bill. Dennis Kucinich offered an amendment that I'm on his bill, and I was the first person that voted for it on committee. He offered an amendment that allows states that want a single payer to be able to waive their ERISA regulations and have single payer, and it passed in our bill in the education and labor.
So if that's part of the final bill, then individual states, California could take a lead and do something stronger than whatever
right.
the final federal version might be.
That's right, and if it doesn't stay in, it's not in the other two bills, we are going to insist on an amendment so we can vote on it on the House during the debate.
Has it been frustrating for you and for the Democrats in the House to see the Senate side moving so much more slowly?
Well, I don't care how slow they move. I just don't want them to be doing everything to appease two senators and two very right and conservative Democrats. I mean, that is not what Barack Obama was elected to be part of, and that's not why we have such a big majority in the House and finally a majority in the Senate. People wanted us to do something. They didn't want us to keep the George Bush status quo in place.
So as the Democratic majority has kind of settled in, it has seemed kind of fractured too.
Well, of course we know that happens, that there's a big tent with the Democrats, but the progressives, we're the largest caucus, Democratic caucus, and we have drawn a line in the sand, which we weren't able to do over Iraq because the caucus was not united over Iraq. They were at the end, but not at the beginning. And but on this health care, we've been united from the very beginning that we would rather have a single payer. We've compromised in supporting a robust public option, and we don't intend to compromise much further.
All right. Well, we do have a caller now, Lynn, who has a question for you, so we'd like to welcome, I believe it's Robert, who is here. Robert, what is your question for the Congresswoman? Let's see, we'll get you. Robert, are you there?
Hello.
Hi. You have a question?
Yes, I do.
What is it?
Congresswoman, do you know if Senator Feinstein supports a public option, as you and Congressman Thompson and Senator Barbara Boxer do?
We have temporarily lost the signal with the Congresswoman. We're going to have to get her back in just a moment, so we'll pick that question up with her as soon as we possibly can. It's going to take us just a moment to get that connection reestablished, and I do apologize for the interruption there. I wanted to quote here from the op-ed piece that the Congresswoman had written recently. It was published in the Marin Independent Journal, and she sort of staked out her position in bold terms, saying that Congress must act now with reform legislation that provides competition to the insurance companies with a robust public plan that guarantees everyone access to high-quality care, regardless of income, employment, or pre-existing conditions. That's what she defines as a robust public plan, and notes that it would provide competition in the marketplace. It is roughly modeled on what Medicare is able to do now, and according to the numbers that they're working with there, would save as much as $75 billion in startup costs. I'm not sure what the interval of time would be for that time. So, Lynn, do we have you back on the line now?
You do have me. Bruce.
All right. So Robert's question was amongst the California delegation. Where is Senator Feinstein on this? Have you had any conversations with her or her office?
Well, Senator Feinstein has not staked out her position yet, as far as I can tell.
So,
I mean, they're letting their I'm not going to speak for Senator Feinstein on this.
So she's more wait and see than some of the other members of the
right.
Department.
And that's up to the general public to let her know what they want, you know.
So I guess that's an invitation to all representatives at this point, that the more public output that there is to see some action, the more likely you will, as a voter, see the kind of action you want.
Well, and I've been suggesting, of course, those that are like myself who are going to do what you want, probably, or probably what you want, would love to hear that, what you know, from you. But make sure you also talk, you know, let your senators know, and also our speaker, because let her know that you're pleased that she's supporting the public option, that you would rather have a single payer if that's where you're coming from. But you absolutely are standing strong for a public option.
The public option has been likened in many respects to Medicare, and often that's pointed to as a successful version of sort of a narrowly targeted single-payer option. And yet there are questions being raised about just how secure is the funding for Medicare. What can you tell us about that?
Well, first of all, the public option will pay its own way. It's not going to be come out of our pocket, the taxpayers' pockets. It will come from the subscribers who choose to be on the Medicaid, the public option plan. So, and something you said about the saving the $75 billion in startup costs. You see, if we use the Medicare infrastructure that's already in place, that means the physician network, and if we base our rates on Medicare, which have already been negotiated and will always continue to be negotiated by the administration, then there's no, I mean, it won't take long. It can be almost immediate.
And the number of people who are still in need of coverage, I've seen some numbers that you were citing here that say that's going up probably by a couple hundred just since we've been talking.
Absolutely. They say 14,000 a day are losing their coverage.
That's just an astonishing number.
I know it. The people, look at all the jobs, the layoffs and all that.
One of the questions that has been raised about health care reform is the need to get away from the model where health care is tied to employment, where it becomes more portable. Do all of the bills address this in any way, or only the public option?
No, the bill addresses, one, there will be no pre-existing conditions. Two, your health carrier cannot drop you if you get sick. And three, if you leave your job, lose your job, or your employer stops covering the employee, you know, having a benefit plan, you move right into, you get to choose whatever plan is, you know, is out there that you want that's available.
Is this the...
Including the public option, of the choices.
And does the public option look a lot like the health plan that the elected representatives have?
Well, yes, there's going to be a basic plan for everybody. We're part of everybody. And then everybody, then people will be able to choose, like we do, which of the plans fits them best. And then they'll be able to buy into that plan. Except if you're covered already by your employer, it's going to be quite a few years before it's going to be worth your while to leave what your employer has and go into another plan, unless you want to pay the whole freight yourself. But so, it will happen over time. It will happen.
If the public option, as it's sort of drafted in the two House bills that are moving forward for reconciliation, if that winds up being the final form of the House bill or even the final bill, is there a danger that would become the end of the conversation, that there would be no further movement toward a universal payer, or do you think it would set the stage for that?
Well, it could set the stage, Bruce. I mean, if the success of the public option will, if people start opting into that plan and dropping their private plan, which that's why the insurance companies are so worried that that might happen. Well, if the public option is cheaper and provides as much or more than the private plans, why wouldn't people opt into it?
Why, indeed.
And that will set the stage for for what we've Medicare for All, or a universal health care plan.
Now, the advocates of universal health care frequently point to Canada or France or the UK as the sort of state-supported model that they see a lot of merit in. How much of their model is being incorporated in the bills that are being addressed on Capitol Hill at this point?
Oh, really none, other than the pre-existing conditions.
That's it.
And what we're doing without the public plan is making health insurance more responsible to their people. But it's not cutting costs, or it's not giving choice unless there's the public option. But I was just up in Banff for an education conference, and the person that was driving me, a Canadian, to the airport from the hotel said, "I have to tell you, we Canadians don't understand what you folks are talking about when you talk about Canada and our health care reform. It is really good." So I thought that was interesting. He just offered that.
So as you go back to work and this predominancy agenda, do you feel that the partisanship of the past couple of years is just as rancorous as it was before, or has that changed at all under the new administration?
Oh, no. Let's see. President Obama would like to change it, but I think he's going to learn pretty quick now that he can do all he can do to get some bipartisan support and give up this and give up that his base wants. And health care is a perfect example of this. Go from a really good health care reform plan to something that's just tweaking the insurance companies, and they're still not going to vote for it. So and in the House, it's impossible.
So the divide is as deep as ever. It's just the numbers that have changed?
The numbers have changed, and of course, the our conservative Democrats, sometimes lean more towards what a moderate Republican would want, but there aren't very many moderate Republicans anymore, so they would have to vote with the Republicans to defeat any bill that they don't like. So, and the progressives can't do that. We never say, well, if you don't do it our way, we're going to vote with the Republicans, because that's not exactly the direction we're going in.
Not at all. Well, Lynn Woolsey, we're just about out of time. I want to thank you very much for talking with us this evening. I hope it has been enlightening for the listenership. And let us mention once again that you will be hosting a town hall meeting in the Petaluma Veterans Memorial Hall on Monday, this coming Monday at 6 p.m. And that's open to anybody who wants to show up at no charge. So if you have some further questions you couldn't get in tonight, perhaps that's another opportunity. And, of course, we will have audio of this up on the KRCB website at krcb.org. Lynn, again, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
You're welcome, Bruce. Thank you for having me.
This has been a special production of KRCB Radio News. I appreciate the technical assistance of Mark Prale and Natalie Freitas. I'm Bruce Robinson. Thank you for listening, and good night. This is KRCB Santa Rosa.